Hello and welcome to the Talking Locksit Locksit podcast. My name is Ade Balogun. On this episode of Talking Locks with Lockitude, I have Innocent. Innocent, you're going to have to pronounce your last name for me again.
Innocent Ikejioba.
Ikejioba.
Yes.
Ikejioba. Sounds like a very powerful name. Well, this is the Chair Convos series, and this time we're actually in the chair. Yeah. So Innocent is my first client that I will be talking to while we're getting his hair done. We're recording live and direct from the Lockitude US studio. This is exciting. I'm excited. It's a beautiful day. It's a warm winter day, if I may say, because we've seen colder days.
I mean, it's a cold winter day for me.
Well, coming from New York, though, I think it's a warm winter day. I should say that Innocent is a long-time client of Lockitude. We started his locks in Lockitude, Lagos, and he has followed us all the way to the US and comes to Ashburn, Virginia every time he has to get his hair done from New York. You are my most faithful client.
Yeah, thank you.
Innocent, thank you. Thank you. I wouldn't do the same for you. I keep telling you.
Oh, it's fair. I mean, it's fair.
Okay, so we actually met in several other circles before Locks.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I remember you remembered me from meeting me earlier mm-hmm. in my several other many professions that I've had.
Yeah.
But the first time I believe we met was after I met Emeka.
Yes. Yeah.
And he was with the Invisible Brothers project.
Yeah.
And he had invited me for a viewing of one of Baldwin's
films,
yeah. Which was interesting.
Yeah. I think so, that was the film on I'm Not Your Negro. Based on Baldwin's The Fire Within. I think it was based on Fire Within. No, based on one of Baldwin's books.
Yeah, but it was interesting and it was nice to meet a different sect of people in Lagos because I feel like the arts world is not one that you find easily. And it was quite interesting that there were people sitting down to discuss some guy called Baldwin. Mm. It was a very interesting event. So moving on from there, I also met you. I think we're doing some other projects when I met you. Can you remember? I thought there was a meeting we went for somewhere in Yaba. I went with my friend Ife Adebayo. It was about like a project for the government. This was so long ago.
Yeah. I vaguely remember that. I deliberately vaguely remember that because part of my personality has wiped anything that has to do with meetings with government. I mean, in the early days of my hustle, so to say, I had a lot of those intersection points where you'd be wondering what might come out of this, and so a meeting comes up, you take it, and in retrospect,
nothing really happens,
and then in retrospect, it turns out to one of those many do nothing meetings, as mm-hmm. I've come to term them, which I don't find ideal anymore. So, I kind of wiped all of those do nothing meetings out of my head.
Well, I feel you.
Yeah.
Well, we cannot lose hope.
Yeah.
We will talk about some Nigerian politics today as we're getting your hair done, but we can definitely not lose hope.
What? If you say so.
We cannot. We cannot. We are the future of Nigeria.
Yeah, safely away from Nigeria.
Maybe we're preserving ourselves so that we can go back to help the country. And then I met you as an organizer of TEDx Yaba.
Yes.
Co-creator and organizer.
Yeah, co-organizer, yeah.
So we've met different times. And yeah. Then I think you contacted me and said, hey, I've met you a few times. I want to lock my hair.
Yeah, I did.
So let's start with your hair since we're on the Talking Locks podcast.
Okay.
Why did a young man like you, responsible, taking government proposal meetings?
I did not have meetings, but not proposal itself.
To lock your hair.
So it's an interesting thing because a number of people I had around me then had dreadlocks. People misattribute who inspired me to actually start locking my hair.
Okay.
They thought maybe it was Emeka because Emeka had dreadlocks for a long time. It wasn't. It wasn't any of those. It was actually someone who was also a customer of yours, who has now cut his locks off, Shegu Famisa.
Oh, yes, I remember Shegu.
Exactly. I was in a... I, I, so a background with me. I'm a very lazy person, especially when it comes to my hair, my skin, all of those stuff. I literally, my approach to it is the do nothing approach, right? So throughout undergrad days and everything, I'll just let my hair grow out and then I'll just cut it all off, let it grow out, cut it all off in cycles like that. There was no method to the madness. But I think in 2016, I started cutting the idea I started generally cutting the idea of wonder what dreadlocks would look like on my head. And I didn't go through with it. I didn't think about it seriously because I felt every single person who had seen their dreadlocks in infancy looked horrible to me. I didn't like the way it looked. I just bothered me the way it looked.
Right? Okay.
And then one day I was in a cafe in 2017. And they've closed cafe now, but it was this Cyber One Cafe, or what's it called the name again? That was in
anybody remember what Cyber Cafe is?
It was really a Cyber Cafe actually. It was just a normal
cafe.
Yeah, it was just a normal cafe in Ozone.
Okay.
I think it was run by these guys that started a coffee company and something.
But New Cafe New.
Exactly.
Cafe New.
So it was Cafe New. So I was in Cafe New in Ozone because I walk out of there sometimes. And Famisa, who I was acquaintances with, I just can't remember how we became acquaintances, but we were acquaintances. He walked in and he was sporting not so old dreadlocks. It was pretty much in the stage of dreadlocks where I was afraid of because I just imagined it to look like spikes on my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the way it looked on his and I felt like, you know what? That actually works for me. It means that not everyone has to have like a very horrible that stage of dreadlocks. So that was on one part, right? That was the inspiration. And then there was the how do I put this? I was also protesting something. About that same time, I don't know if they still do this, I don't know if you remember this, but Nigerian banks kind of make you update your picture for your accounts every like 5 years or so.
Okay.
They will be like, oh, this doesn't look like you anymore. You have to go. And it's a whole stupid, tedious, it's not necessarily long, just tedious process. And I just gone through that. And I remember the day I was doing that, I was really pissed. I'm like, it doesn't make sense. Like, I could come in here in a year and not look like this. Mm-hmm. Right? So what exactly would... So I promised myself, you know what? When they asked me that I needed to do that, I went and I got a clean shave. and updated my account image, my account photograph, and I started growing out my hair. And the plan was that
they would ask you again.
They would ask me again, but it wouldn't be according to them. Like after 5 years, you have to, but it won't be up to 5 years, so I won't have to, and I won't. Be, and I won't.
You
won't
do it.
So I don't know if you remember, but when I started, I told people like, well, the deadline is 5 years because the plan was when it gets to that 5 years and I then take that image again.
You don't want to have the locks anymore.
I'll then go and cut it off. Just mess with them in quiet protests. I like quiet protests. So that was also that happening at the same time. And then the third motivating factor was I felt it was something long-term to do with my hair. As opposed to the constant cycles of shave,
grow,
exactly. And I felt, I even though a lot of people were like, oh, it's not a hairstyle, you just let be, like, as a usual stylist.
Yeah.
I felt like it was a hairstyle I could try letting be. Because I don't know if you remember, you told me at the first appointment that one of the ways people could have dreadlocks is to freeform. Just let your hair be. And I was like, so why the fuck did people say I can't just let it be? Pardon the French. I don't know if swearing is allowed. But that was my thinking then. Like,
yeah, so apparently, the few podcasters I've had on have been swearing. So I guess now we are an explicit
No, I don't swear too much. But when it comes, I just let it rip. I don't have any problem with it. So it was this balance of three things. One, I found it was a hairstyle I could carry for longer and just let be and do seasonal maintenance. Two, I found someone who I felt like the way the style looked on him, the dreadlocks looked on him, actually worked fine and I felt like that's what I wanted. And then three, I was protesting the bank's policy.
Okay.
So that's how I end up here.
And if I remember correctly, Shegun started his hair at Lockitude.
Yeah, he did. So, I believe so.
Yeah, I think so. I think so because I met Shegun while working at Conga. I don't know that I worked with him for very long or our time overlaps, but I know our connection was a Conga connection when I worked at Conga. So interesting. How long have you had your locks now?
As at yesterday, it was 6 years and a month.
Oh.
So today is 6 years, a month and a day. But who's counting? No one is counting.
Who is counting, counting? Who is counting? But 6 years.
A month and a day.
I know nobody can see us on the podcast, but Innocent's hair is long, luscious, thick, full.
Thank you.
And requires my muscles to get it done.
Yeah. I also tell people it's genetics. That's if you have any opportunity to marry one from my family, please do. We have hair in our family, so especially the men. I don't know about the women, but the men have hair.
Are you putting an ad out there for yourself?
Oh no, I'm putting just my generations and my family members and everyone. So yeah, we have good hair.
Anyway, so but there's an eligible bachelor in the house. Just saying. Moving on.
Yeah,
moving on.
Eligibility is up for contest, but yeah, moving on.
Okay, moving on. So at the time I met Emeka, I know he was in the middle of or rounding up or doing something around Invisible Borders. And I thought it was an amazing project, which I understand you were a part of.
Yeah, yeah.
So can you tell us what is Invisible Borders? What was it? What did you do? And did you really make those borders invisible? Do borders exist, or is it a fiction of our imagination?
I mean, in a certain way, borders are artificial. I mean, you could also argue that what isn't artificial, but borders are artificial in the sense that it was structurally imposed on us and doesn't particularly align with our relationship flows, so to say.
Oh, natural, cultural borders.
Exactly. It doesn't align with what is natural in that sense. People flow across place and time. Historically, we've always migrated as humans. So, in that sense, you could say borders are invisible, but borders are pretty much visible. When you get to the border checkpoint and you have to present your passport with your visa, but on an ideological level, there is also a question of how to make these borders more invisible in terms of how to share what binds us more than what divides us in that sense. So there is that part. But yeah, I was part of Invisible Borders Trans African project from 2016 to 2020 when I left. I served as a project manager of the organization and did the 2016 Trans Nigerian Road Trip, the 2017 Trans Nigerian Road Trip, 2018 Trans African Road Trip, and then the 2020 Trans Bangladeshi Road Trip.
Okay, that sounds a lot and exciting. Let's start with the Trans-Nigerian Road Trip. How many states in Nigeria have you been to?
Have I been to? Yeah. I think I have been to 33.
Okay, more than anybody I know, actually. So well done. You might be good running for some political position.
Well,
in the future.
A politician we met on one of those trips, I think it was somewhere in the state house in Nasarawa, he said that we should add to the constitution that a criteria for running for any political office in any area is you should have traveled that area fully.
I agree.
So if you're running for governor, you not just traveling for campaign, you must have been to every local government and constituent there. If you're running for president, you must have been to every state. If you're running for local government, you must have been to every constituent and every area of... So
it makes sense to me, because I've been fortunate to... I've been to about maybe 20, 22 Nigerian states. And every time I talk politics, I like to talk politics, and I'm not in any way trying to make Lokiti become a political platform, but I enjoy talking politics on my personal time. And I find that a lot of people who you have these arguments with about the president, the this, the that, the cost of oil, they have no context of what Nigeria is. It's usually through the lens of where you are.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the scope of how huge a nation that claims to have over 200 million people is. So it's interesting. I would, in case my daddy calls me from the presidency to recommend somebody who knows Nigeria, I'll be putting you up.
I mean, if it's this current presidency, I'll pass. But yeah, subsequently, maybe.
Okay. All right. So you've been to almost every Nigerian states. For people who may not know, Nigeria has 36 states.
Yeah, and you've been to 33.
So 37 plus.
Yeah, so it's 36 plus one.
Plus one.
Yeah.
So you've been to 33, just four left. What did this project do when it went to all these places?
Yeah, so by nature of the project, we traveled by road, first and foremost. That was a very key part of the project. And we traveled as a group of writers, photographers, filmmakers, basically visual artists and writers in that sense. And we based on whatever team the particular trip is on, we engaged the spaces we found ourselves in. So on one end, it was also a... Because, I mean, it was 2016 and 2017, right? And
political landscape was
tedious, to put it lightly. Boko Haram was doing their thing, and we did go to Yola and Maiduguri in that period of time also, in 2016. But there was also that question of engaging the particular differences and unity conversation in Nigeria, right? And having all of these artists and these writers look at it from their point of view, pursuing different projects, but through their different projects also engaging the narrative of, is Nigeria really divided or is it really unified, as various narratives try to put forward? And if it isn't united, if it isn't unified, how particularly does that change? What is the opinion? What is the view? What is the experience of the man in Yola compared to the man in Makurdi? How has Nigeria been of value to the man in Ayara Market in Aba, or the man in Kogi State, for example, the bricklayer in Kogi State, in Lokoja? So it was being able to look through all of that. And at the same time, one of the artists was also looking through the lens of the Nigerian civil war, the conversations around it, by also engaging people who played a role in some way in the civil war. So I said played a role in some way because, for example, when we're in Asaba, we interviewed two people. One is a member of the IPOB. I can't say member. I don't think it was a member, but it was a huge supporter of IPOB. And the other person we interviewed, and actually there were three people. The other person we interviewed there was someone who witnessed what is known as the Asaba genocide, which is something that most people don't know about in Nigeria, but it was a particular mass killing by the Nigerian army of people in Asaba and dumped into mass graves.
Was this before the civil war?
During
the civil war.
Yeah, and so this is someone who escaped by the skin of his pants, so to say, because he was in the field where the killing was done, and he happened to be the dad of one of the writers who was on the project, so we were able to have that conversation with him. At the same time, when Edo State in Benin, we interviewed this man who fought for the Biafran army and then for the Nigerian army and then for the Biafran army, depending on whoever took control of the city he was.
He fought for
exactly.
Them.
So for him, fighting for those wasn't because he wanted to, just because it was the only means
of being alive
and surviving. So the point is, we explored Nigeria through lenses of past, present, and possibilities of the future at the same time. And I think a key part of that is also allowing some of those stories and some of those experiences from those places to come to the fore and be heard.
Does this body of work exist on any platforms that can be seen? Because it feels like such an important body of work for people whose history has been deleted from our curriculum.
Yeah, I know we published a couple of chapbooks from the writers back then. So for the first we called it Borders Within, for the Trans-Nigerian road trips. So for the first Borders Within in 2016, I think we published three chapbooks from three writers, Uche, Emmanuel, and Yinka. And then for the second one, we published, I think, four chapbooks this time around, from the four writers that we had with us, right? We had four writers, yeah. So those chapbooks are a repository of some of those writings. Also, some of these works have been exhibited around the world. And I think you could also find some of the work on Invisible Borders website. So if you Google Invisible Borders, you might, you should be able to find some of the works, or at least find information on where the work might be showing anytime soon.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, let's talk about the Trans Africa for a minute here. Mm-hmm. I understand that was everybody on the project Nigerian?
Oh, for Trans Africa, no.
Okay.
No, not at all.
All right. So how, I know that as a Nigerian, your passport is only valid through West Africa. So when you said you did a Trans Africa trip, was it West Africa or
Did
you see other parts of Africa? And how did you navigate the systems of having to apply for visas to get through these borders that exist but are supposed to be invisible?
Well, I think that's where my job came in. As a project manager. So I think the first thing I did was did a huge spreadsheet of all the countries in Africa where we could possibly be getting participants from on one column, and then all the countries from Africa on another column that we might go through based on the route we want to travel.
Okay, and because it had to be by road.
Yeah, it had to be by road. And then I started matching visa requirements. Right, for all of them, matching them like one after the other. I mean, your Nigerian passport, like you said, it gives you access to West Africa for free, maximum of 90 days. But it also, because of a relationship with Cameroon, gives you access to Cameroon also.
Oh, you can actually get into Cameroon without a visa?
Wait, without a visa? You don't need a visa.
I didn't know this.
You need a visa to go to Cameroon.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. My brother-in-law is actually supposed to go to, well, we're also an American, so I never need one. Yeah,
it'll be fine. However, then the commission starts getting, so for that particular road trip, the plan, I say plan, was to travel from Nigeria through Cameroon and then through CAR and then to DRC, then from DRC to Rwanda. I think from Rwanda, we're supposed to then head to Uganda. Can't remember all of the stops now, but we then end it in Maputo in Mozambique.
So like just a straight line.
So it's just like from here we go this way. And the idea was we're kind of trailing, we're kind of mapping the prehistoric Bantu migration routes.
Okay. No, you have to educate me.
Okay. Cliff Notes version. In the early days of the African continents. Okay, no, let me take it back, even though it's a Cliff Notes version. Humans migrate. That is what we do. That is what we know how to do best.
Okay.
There is resources here, we move. There is no resources here, we leave.
Yeah.
It's that simple. We follow the path of rivers, we follow the path of need and all of these things.
Food,
right?
Food, shelter,
yeah.
Agriculture.
That is how there happen to be humans in every part of the world, because at some point someone decided to get the fuck up and move.
Okay.
So, there was a particular migration route. There's a particular group called the Bantu people, which kind of makes up a significant amount of African country right now. There are other, and when I say the Bantu people, it's not a tribe per se. It is rather what you find as a group of tribes. A lot of tribes from current modern day originate from the Bantus, for example.
Okay.
And there are a lot of tribes that also don't originate from the Bantu. So the Bantu people had, I think there were two Bantu migration routes that happened. I know there are two. Well, there are two, at least two. I can't remember the particular route of both of them, but I remember that one of the routes, I think of the second Bantu migration, went from what is today southeast and south-southern Nigeria through that point in West Africa, traveled through central Africa eastward, and then traveled southwards. I believe the particular migration route ended at about, and please, no one should crucify me for this, at about Zambia. And I remember, Zambia and Zimbabwe were part of the place we were going to travel to during that road trip. But so it ended around that Maputo, Namibia, Zambia, region of Southern Africa. So this particular route, this particular migration is actually said to be responsible for some of the population of that particular region. And this, according to some people, is why you find a lot of, I don't know if you know Zambians and Zimbabweans, but if you see their name written, not here, if you see the name written and you see an Igbo name, some Igbo names written,
it seems like the same thing.
You are tempted to use the pronunciation of the Igbo name to pronounce that. And so some people say it's because it's still part of the same Bantu family of tribes.
Mm.
That's why that is. I don't know how true that is, but the point is the Bantu migration was kind of responsible for part of the population of that particular region of Africa. So we're
following the second
Bantu migration route so we're kind of like tracing it and then using that history to layer with modern day occurrences in those spaces, like what was happening in Goma, in DRC Goma, what has happened in Rwanda, in Rwanda's history, the issue of accessibility through Sierra was something we're really keen on, the relationship between Nigeria and Cameroon, and also the conflict in Cameroon with the Bazonia.
Yeah.
Was part of the things we're kind of like exploring in modern time, layered with the historical Bantu migration routes. So that was kind of the gist. That's interesting. Yeah.
I hardly have any spare time in my life now, but I think at some point I would hope to go find some of those publications that were made from the trip, because there's so little that we know more about other Western countries than we know about ourselves as Africans.
Yeah, it seems so.
Okay, that was amazing work, and I feel like it must have been eye-opening.
I mean, I should reiterate, I am not an artist, so I didn't partake in the road trip as a filmmaker, a photographer, a writer. No, I was just doing logistics and project management. Mine was just make sure that we have a place to stay in the next place, make sure that the artists have people to speak to based on the projects they were working on. When we wanted to do showings, in quotes, like mini exhibitions, make sure that was able to happen smoothly and seamlessly, and just think about the next place and then the next place while people are currently working on ground.
Well, thank you for your humility. In my opinion, you were part of that project in a very big way, because I can imagine leaving the logistics to the artists to plan. I mean,
they have done prior to my journey in Invisible Borders,
they had done some projects.
There was the Lagos to Sarajevo road trip by road from Lagos to Europe. So,
okay.
So yeah, it's a whole thing.
Okay.
So yeah. Anyway, just to wrap up the thing, so I had to just like do that on the visa and then start trying to reach out to the different ministries, consulates of the countries we're going to, and that didn't yield any results.
Hmm.
I was trying to reach out for partnerships and acknowledgements and stuff like that, because that would have made it easier
to go through.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
But that didn't yield any results, except for one thing. I remember the then ambassador to Nigeria from CAR asking me, what exactly are you going to do there? we end up having to skip CAR for security reasons. But yeah, we had to then get the visas based on the artists from whence they come and which country we're going to.
Whoever required a visa, then exactly. You got a visa for them.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, this kind of led you down, and correct me if I'm wrong, the path of being an artist manager. And I know you recently just finished a master's in the US here. So can you tell us a little bit about how you interact with the art world and these artists beyond projects like Invisible Borders?
Yeah, so it led me down the path of art management, not artist manager, administration.
Art management.
Yeah, so art administration and management. So I think what happened was during my time with Invisible Borders, I got very curious about the curatorial and the idea of being a curator. And did an exhibition in Lagos in 2019, myself and Yinka Lujoba. And about the same time, I started also attending like a couple of curatorial programs. And then I was so, on one end in my head, there was all of this experience with traveling with artists and Invisible Borders and having to manage logistics. And on the other end, I was also encountering the curatorial aspect of art. And I realized that a much more urgent need, at least for my immediate environment, was what I then called like a curation of people, as opposed to artworks and events and all of that.
Okay.
More about how do we ensure that the
people are seen.
Exactly. That the people in this industry, the people in this ecosystem, in this world, are able to do what they need to do, how they need to do, when they need to do it. And that became a sort of a preoccupation of mine. So when I decided to then do a master's in art administration, well, in art and cultural management, that was kind of the path I was towing. So that obsession of mine, that focus of mine led to creating a non-profit of my own after I left Invisible Borders in 2020 called The Drill. And the idea of The Drill was an organization that was strictly focused on ensuring the African arts practitioner is able to live a sustainable life, is able to...
Because artists are usually predominantly broke people, right?
That's the narrative. That's the narrative, right? And even at that, they make it, it's not everyone, like very few of them really
the
make it out.
The percentage of people who become like world-class artists or
who
renowned.
Exactly. It doesn't mean they make better work.
They're probably
world-class,
but yeah.
I often tell people that when I started The Drill, I had a particular, I have a friend who, he was the ideal, he was the person I was solving for, so to say.
Okay.
This friend, he was actually the one who got me interested in photography for starters, which then led me into art. And we're in undergrad together in Ife. His name is Leko Oshunino. I don't know if you ever listened to this, but Leko Oshunino, when we're in university in Ife, he was into photography and film and all of that right from university. I studied English language and literary studies. We served together in Oshogbo, and he was really taking his photography seriously, and I got involved in it and everything. We discussed possible projects we could do and all of this. So I knew he had a passion for photography. About the time I started The Drill, about that time, Lekon is also like a really, really good graphic designer. He was like a really good designer, I would say now, but back in school, he was the go-to graphic designer in our department. So about the time I started The Drill, just before I did, Lekon had not entirely quit photography, but had dropped the camera to just take up jobs, design jobs, and not to, you know, fend for himself and his family and all of that. And gradually, I watched as Lekon went deeper and deeper into the design and the corporate world and further away from his arts.
Yeah, his passion.
Exactly. I remember the last time I don't know if Lekon remembers this, but the last time I actually discussed anything in regards to his art with him was when he then told me that, oh, he just bought a new camera, but he just bought body, he hasn't bought lens. Like, he hasn't bought the lens yet, just the camera body. I felt disheartened that this is someone who I know had a real passion, and not just passion, had a real good eye for photography. And this is what it had come to, where he had to choose to either get photography equipment or, you know, survive on his own in that sense. So that was what I was solving for. And my question was, how can I make Lekon, for example,
known because he's a good artist and
not just
a passionate person.
Exactly. And not just known. What are the things in Lekon's life that needs to be solved for him to be able to focus on his art? Mm-hmm. And then things like contracts came into my mind. Financial management came to mind. Health came to mind. Now, all of these things are not... When you hear someone has an art organization, you don't imagine that these are the things they cover.
Yeah.
But without these things...
You only
things,
think about the artwork.
Exactly. If you don't have to worry about these things, you can worry about... If you know that your legal end is covered, if you know that your health is fine, if you know that your finance is well managed, if you know that you have an administrator taking care of whatever you need, then you can focus on your art. Then you don't have to live from day to day. Then you can actually have like long-term investments in it. And these are the things I thought about.
And you potentially not to look for a corporate job to
then,
make ends
exactly
meet, and
because
then the arts becomes the...
The by the way.
Yeah.
Because I believe it is actually possible to have a sustainable career in the arts, solely in the arts. And I think when you then do that, you are able to then have your art address cogent issues without having to worry that this person that is giving me one night out from on the side might be angry with the issue I'm trying to address and back out of funding me for one thing or the other. So that thought kind of snowballed into more systematic problems that also affected the African arts ecosystem, which then made me realize that, you know what, maybe I need to get a degree to be able to further research this and, you know, develop systematic ways of solving systematic problems.
Okay, so question, does the drill still exist today?
Yes, the drill still exists. We're currently working on a couple of partnerships with some organizations around Africa for programming, because the idea was, it's not supposed to be just restricted to Nigerian arts practitioners. Hopefully we're going to have a couple of programs by the last quarter of this year in, let's just say, East and Southern Africa. Let's not put the country to it yet.
Okay.
But hitherto, we've done some webinars and some sessions where we had a whole series of sessions that was focused on financial management for artists. Like, we called it Art and Money. Looking at the relationship between art and money, how to survive in that space, how to think about money as an artist or as a cultural producer, as the case may be. Also, how to do grants and proposal writing in that sense. So, yeah, the drill still exists. And we did go and buy a 2-year hiatus, but we just got fully back into gear with a collaboration with Proto Cinema for a film screening in Lagos recently. Which is one of the reasons why I was back in Lagos.
Okay.
So this year we're back into programming mode, and every year we're going to have at least 2 programming related to, you know, providing for the sustenance of the artists and the art practitioner. The core for the drill and the way I approach it is care, so to say, is how exactly do you imbibe care as a practice into the lives of these people, and how do you care for all of these other people who have chosen to look into the world's problem through their art.
That's interesting. And does The Drill have a website or somewhere we can find you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. TheDrill.org is the website. I was surprised that that domain was
available. How come it was available?
I remember I was walking on the road to go and buy Akara. And I was like, we should do TheDrill.org. Like, and I just checked. And it was available. I stopped in the middle of the road and I made a 5-year purchase of the domain there and then. I'm like, I'll figure everything out later, but that is going to be
the domain. That's amazing because domains are almost impossible to find these days. Yeah. You know, I have Locketeer with a knife in the middle because who even is using the Locketeer thing?
Yeah, you make up a word. And then you find that someone already has
someone else made up the word too.
So just check thedrill.org. You find us there or on social media, just thedrill.org, thedrill.org together. And
Okay. That's amazing work. And so this whole path has kind of brought you down to America.
Yep.
And now you have been educated in a Western system, because I know you did mention here that you went to Ife.
Yeah.
I'm assuming your primary school, secondary school was all in Nigeria.
Yes, they were.
And
all
your
in
master's
Nigeria.
Was your first exposure to international learning.
Yep.
You know, real life.
Well, international
schooling.
Proper, because I've had other like non-formal. Like all of the, like in a sense, all of the art
projects.
Academy and stuff I went on, because I did a couple of like curatorial intensives, residencies and all of that stuff. They were learning also, but they're not like the traditional formal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, the US was my first formal learning structure.
So compared to the learning structure in Nigeria, are there like any differences? Does it really, you know, the thing, because I worked corporate in Nigeria and oftentimes when somebody comes with any foreign degree, is automatically better than your Nigerian degree that's to the human resource department. But these people start work are not necessarily all that fantastic or even have the context of the country to be able to be effective at their jobs. So does an international degree really set you apart? Did you enjoy the learning? What made it different from how we learn back home?
I think that's one question can be broken into 2 questions. One, why do we, as Nigerians back in Nigeria, seem to value international degrees more? I think it's very simple. It's a suffering factor. It just feels like this person has not suffered. This person learns in comfort. So maybe this person's head is cushioned very well to provide ideas.
That's funny.
But there is a huge difference. Even on almost every level, there are huge differences between the the Nigerian education system and the American education system. I mean, like I said, on the surface, for example, what we call a lecturer in Nigeria is a professor here, right? Mm-hmm. And then in Nigeria, you go from being a lecturer to being a doctor after you get your PhD, and then you go on to being a professor, and if the gods are nice to you, you might become a professor emeritus. And when you go from lecturer to doctor, you deliberately make sure everyone calls you Dr. This and no longer Mr. That.
Yeah.
And then when you become a professor, you make sure they call you Professor This or Professor That.
Yep.
Now, this is a very superficial level. But over here, everyone who teaches is a professor. And then when they become a doctor, then they get called Dr. This and Dr. That. But you get called Professor first
before you get called Doctor.
So it's just that's, I always find that rather interesting. It kind of affects the way people interact with them. But
does affect or it doesn't?
Oh, it does. It really does. So
you interact with a doctor in a different way than you would interact with a professor, here?
So what happened was, not so long ago, someone wrote an email to one of the professors in my department, and I was in CC. And the department's office was also in CC. And I was having this conversation with one of our graduate assistants. But it was like, that email was so funny, the way the person kept on saluting and like, oh, Dr. D's, and kept on saluting. And I said, so it turned out the person, I first said, made this email before, found out that the person who sent the email was Indian. And was sending from India. I was like, it's very possible. It's cultural. Like the person has is such that if someone has this title,
you have to regard it
every single time. And that was actually what happened. So there is that. So here you call your professors by first name. Hi, Chris. Hi, Mary. Hi, Richard.
Well, they're just lecturers.
Yeah, you don't do that in Nigeria. Like, it has to be referenced. Like, they make you realize that it took us work to get to this point. So there is that difference in communication. And I think it affects learning. Because here, you suddenly have this relaxed learning atmosphere. You have this, beyond the four walls of the classroom, you feel you can still learn from the person. Because the person is, there is this, the high bar is removed, right? There is this leveling, so to say, especially if you're doing a graduate course, like a master's. Or whatever, right? So there is this level of knowledge is going both ways, right, in that sense. Whereas in Nigeria, there is much rigid and structured, not just structured, rigid, that makes it like you've been fed, so to say.
Yeah, and you shouldn't question.
Exactly, and you shouldn't bite the hand that feeds you also in that sense. So there is a fear factor in the relationship with your professors or your lecturers in Nigeria that is not often found here. You could easily disagree. You could also sue your professors. So I think
you
that affects
contest
learning.
Your grades.
You could contest your grades. Exactly. So I think that affects learning. I think that might be one thing.
That is more advantageous on this side.
However, I think not having that in the ground level of my education was an advantage for me too, because it meant that I've seen the worst that it can be. So it's not like I've always had this particular relationship, but now that I have it, I know exactly how to use it to the fullest.
Right. I think I feel you on that one, because there are a few things that I've experienced in America here, and you realize that we are starved of opportunities in Nigeria. So when you see an opportunity, you don't wait, you take it. And the typical Americans, like, you know, they're talking about how they feel, if they're triggered, untriggered. And I'm like, oh, take the opportunity and decide if you are triggered later, you know? So I do relate to that. That's, you know how to take advantage of things when you know what the other side can be like. Oh, that's interesting. So did you learn anything in this program?
Oh, yeah, I did. I learned a lot. Okay. A lot. A lot of useful things, some unuseful things. probably most useful has to do with navigating political systems. So, I mean, in
that's
the
interesting.
Aspect.
And arts management masters.
Yeah, I mean,
intersects with politics.
Yeah, definitely.
Arts is always used in political discourse.
Exactly. Yeah. So I humble brag got employed as a faculty member after I graduated. I don't know why you're
where
clapping.
Where is the...
I don't know why you're clapping. It's just a part-time gig. But I was
congratulations.
Say,
you're yeah, too humble.
I was going to say that... So the class, the first class I taught, along with one of the professors who taught me, was the cultural policy class. So that basically houses some of the interactions between arts and policymaking. I think one of the things I told the students, and I happy I kind of know, is whether we like it or not, policy will be made that affects people in the art and cultural space, whether we like it or not. It is, however, our duty as art managers, if we can, to position ourselves. You see, I was once trying to do a project in Kenya, and I learned about this particular space in Kenya. I can't remember the name of the space now. Even if I do, I don't want to mention it. Just for, I don't know, just so that no one comes to fight me. But the space was started by someone. It was an art space, and they had a peculiar model that provided space, a studio space and everything for up-and-coming artists and all of that stuff. My point is, this particular person develop an arts nonprofit, grew it so well that when the city in Nairobi wanted to do some land planning around that space, she was invited to the table to have the conversation of how to use the land, how to segment the land, how to share it and whatever. And that's why I tell the students that it is important for you to position yourself as art managers in a place where you could make significant contributions to your community in that way, through policymaking. Because everything we do right now, right, in the US, if you register an arts nonprofit, you register as a 501c3, there is financial laws that are governing that. There are financial laws that are governing the things you have to disclose. There are financial laws governing what you could do as a 501c3, if you could lobby or not, and all of that stuff. This is because there are people who made those policies. If you employ someone, there are laws on how you're going to report your employment and all of those stuff, even if you're employed. All of this has to do with policymaking. If you take on a public art installation work, there are laws around what you can put where and how you can put them, depending on the city and the state. All of this come down to policymaking. And then there's also the part of planning. There is so much you could do in the culture and art field when it comes to that, if you are able to position yourself to be called into that room. So it's kind of a bit of an interesting thing in which I was able to adapt, because I did know about cultural policy before coming to the program, but how to basically
position yourself and realize that you are important is not
exactly
just something
important
that
to the conversation.
It's going to happen regardless of you, so you better
exactly.
be part of it.
You better be part of it because you have something interesting to contribute to the conversation.
Nice. Okay, so now you take classes yourself. You are a faculty, what did you call it?
There's a part-time faculty member.
Yeah, a faculty member. How do you find would you say there's a language barrier for you?
Nope.
Between you and your students, and you as a student who was a recent student yourself, you feel like maybe you're not understood or...
Oh, I know I'm not understood sometimes, but I don't think it's a barrier. And, I'm not understood for two reasons. One, accent. I don't care about that barrier. And the reason is...
You don't care about the
the barrier of accent, like, oh, they can't understand the way I speak. I don't care for it. Because what they don't realize is it also takes me tuning my ear to understand what they're saying. To understand that if an American wants to say this word, this is how they'll say it.
Water. Right,
and all of exactly. So and now imagine they say all of those in a fluid sentence. It then becomes auditory training for myself. I don't mind because I'm the one who is listening, right? I take the time to listen to what they're saying. Now, I do understand that sometimes my accent can really, really go deep. And in those cases, I would repeat myself over and over again when I know that I may not be. But generally speaking, I think it is a responsibility of a listener, especially in a language as how do I put it, as localized as English, because different parts have their Englishes. Like,
yep.
When I speak to my South African friends, the way the English sounds come out is different from the way it sounds coming out of my mouth. When I'm speaking to my Ugandan friends, it's different. When I'm speaking to friends
even
Korea,
between our,
even in Nigeria, from between Nigeria, Hausa man, it's different, right?
Yeah.
But I've learned that I can't keep on putting the onus on them to repeat themselves over and over again. So I have to
tune
my ear every time I'm listening, even when I'm listening to an European or even to the British person.
Yep.
So if someone thinks that I am not understandable because of my accent, I think the person is lazy. It doesn't mean that in some conversations I won't repeat myself. I will. I'm not being distant. But if the person then goes back on and says, oh, I can't really understand that person because of the way he sounds, then I'm like, it's your personal problem.
Yeah.
The other reason why I'm often not understood is cultural. So, I kind of grew up understanding that when you have to explain something, you explain it with stories and proverbs.
Okay, yes.
So, yeah. When someone asks
let me tell you a story.
Exactly. Like, it's like how I wanted to talk about policy, and I went to talk about the person in
Kenya.
Nairobi, right?
Yeah.
So, when I'm in class, or when the students, or even like colleagues and friends, when we're having conversation about something, that is how I explain things. I explain things by taking you on a story.
Yeah.
Like this, okay. Or a Yoruba proverb, an Igbo proverb, any one of those. It is always not an English proverb. It's always a Yoruba or Igbo proverb translated to English.
And it's not appreciated, is it?
So for some people, they are able to get it. But for some people, they're like, it takes so long for me to finalize and for them to understand. Why don't they just make things easier? And I'm like, listen, this is culturally for me, the best way to explain anything is through a story or through proverbs. Because there's an Igbo version of this, there's a Yoruba version of this. The Yoruba versions go something like Owe Leshen or Leshen Owe, Bo Ebason or Laughing Wa, Bo Ebason or Laughing Wa.
I am Yoruba, but I do not understand that.
Okay, so I'm going to say it in English. You can cut out the Yoruba part. All right. It directly translates to proverbs are the horses on which words ride. Words are the horses on which proverbs ride. Mm. If words are lost, we find them with proverbs. If proverbs are lost, we find them with words.
That's beautiful.
And then there's the Igbo version that says something like proverbs is the...
Can you say it in Igbo as well?
I can say it in Igbo, but the problem is I'm not even remembering it fully now. I can't remember the order of it, but it goes something like proverbs is the oil with which we eat words, and words is the oil with which we eat proverbs. So why in the Yoruba they are riding horses, and this one they are eating something?
It's in oil and yam.
Yeah, exactly. So that is kind of my approach to explaining things. I explain it through stories and proverbs in that sense, because I feel like when there is a story in your head, you remember it. We remember stories better than formulas.
Yeah, I have been accused here of not being able to answer questions by yes or no.
Exactly.
Because every time I'm asked a question, I will say, what happened?
Exactly.
This is the context. I have to build the whole picture for you. And some people have gotten very frustrated with me by...
That's it.
Things are highly yes or no.
Yes or no. Like, it's...
Maybe we understand ourselves because we are born and raised in Nigeria.
Yeah, exactly. If you ask me, why is this, I could just say yes, no, or this.
But that's not the full picture.
But that doesn't give you the full picture. That doesn't let you understand the nuances
involved. What is really
happening?
You know, I feel you. I completely feel you. Let's go back to your hair for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So coming to America with long, luscious locks and getting into a master's program, being a black man. So there's the complexity of not just being a man with hair, but there's now another additional complexity of being a black man with hair in New York.
Yep.
Have you had any experiences, or is that something that just goes over your head?
It goes over my head because I don't care. If you see me on the streets of New York, the image I strike is headphones on, heads facing the ground, just walking on my own. I don't care what anyone thinks. I don't care how anyone feels. Because there was something the Nigerian dancer and performer Kuduzo Nikeko once said. It was one of those screenings that we had in Pariga in Lagos. He talked about a performance he did. So this is now a story within a story. A performance he did sometimes in Lagos in France, I think. And after the performance, the woman walked up to him and said, "Oh, your performance moved me so much. It made me feel this and that and whatever." And then he corrected her and said, "I can't take responsibility for how you feel, because you, how you feel is a combination of what you saw and your experiences." Mm. Right. So for every way someone reacts to anything, it's not just that thing, but also a mixture of that thing and their lived experiences or their experiences in general. So any way anyone reacts to seeing me as a black man in the streets of New York with dreadlocks, I just, I just chuck it down to
their experiences.
Like, and I'm not there to validate their experiences. I'm not there to make them feel better about themselves. Neither am I there to make them feel worse about themselves. I'm there for myself.
Yeah, but it's interesting how, do you feel you've ever been profiled?
Oh, I have been profiled, but was that, I've been profiled in Lagos. Mm-hmm. I've been profiled in Austria. And maybe because all of this happened much earlier, before me coming to the US, I know I have kind of been softly profiled in the US by a colleague, but I just feel like the person maybe didn't know better. But once again, maybe because I've had like much serious profiling related situation, I have kind of decided to, you know what, unless the person wants to be direct with me,
yeah,
I'm just not going to pay attention.
It takes
a lot of energy,
yeah,
from me
to even understand that you're being profiled.
Yeah, like to translate it. Like, for example, the first one that happened in Salzburg in Austria, it was simply, I was walking on the sidewalk. There was ample space for anyone to walk on the sidewalk. And then a particular white woman, saw me cross to the other side of the road. After I walked past, she crossed back. Initially, I didn't. And I turned back, I saw that she was back. I'm like, what just happened? But the point is, it took me some sort of, I ran into that woman again at the bus stop some days later, and I was standing with another black person, a woman, and she was, I can't even describe like her reaction of like staying away from us while we're both waiting for the bus or the tram. And the fact that I had to go through all of this, I just feel like, and this is serious, the things that happen, right? I'm not in any way reducing or minimizing it, but I realized that I can't expend my energy on your biases in that sense, like on that type of bias that you might have on me.
Yeah.
You should be the one using your energy, not me wasting my own energy. I have other things to do with my energy. So I kind of like, I'm now in a stage where if you have any problem with me and you can't come and say it to me, then that's your personal problem.
Okay. And how has your decision to lock your hair as an Igbo Nigerian man, how has that impacted your family? Your dad, your mom, your cousins, your brothers, your sisters?
They know they can't do anything about it. They've accepted it for what it is.
But was it ever difficult?
Oh, yeah, it was. So a bit of background. My mom is an ordained reverend in a church. Right, she's a pastor, ordained reverend and everything. So
I'm a pastor.
Exactly. So and my dad is a retired police officer. Exactly.
Best of both worlds.
So I remember when I was still growing up my hair before I locked my hair, I went to the airport one day to pick up my dad. And that was probably the first time I was seeing the hair properly, green growing out. Right in the
growing out, not
yeah,
locked.
Not locked yet. Right in Murtala Mohammed Airport there, right in the arrival, because I went inside to help him get his stuff. He just paused and said, like, "What is this? What is this? Go on, go on." I just left for him to feel like, "Are you done? Can I get your bags now?" But I know that over the years, not just with this, even with my pursuing a career within the arts, there were a lot of things about me they did not understand, but they've learned to accept over time.
But you would think that within the arts, though, locks would be very much, or hair is generally accepted.
I mean, for my family, that is. For my family, like, they didn't understand.
So you pursuing arts.
They are, exactly,
you
carrying the arts.
Carry hair.
Exactly.
Yeah,
they didn't understand it.
Are you the black sheep in your family?
I don't think we have a black sheep in our family. Because if we want to, all of us are black sheep. What we should be looking for is who is the white sheep? Exactly. That's the other thing we inherit in my family, stubbornness and, you know. So in that regard, it's that my parents have now accepted that this is what. And I know, when I got to the US, I had subtle hints from my dad, my uncle, my aunt who is in the US, my uncle in the US, about how life is going to be more difficult for me because I have dreadlocks and I should consider cutting it. They were very subtle with it. They are no longer saying that, oh, what's this on your head? It's more like, do you want life to be difficult for you?
Are you just making your own life
exactly
hard?
And you should consider cutting it in that sense. So I do understand it's an adjustment for them. I do understand it's not particularly easy for them. But I also understand that they know that they can't do anything about it unless I choose to do something about it. So they've accepted that. And so much so that my mother was being ordained driven. I was in Lagos. She invited me, knowing the doctrines, knowing what it's like in the church. Because I also grew up in that church. I had looks by then. And I grew up in the church, right? So I knew what it might look like for a reverend and a
reverend's
who heads,
son.
Exactly, who heads one of the local churches to turn up with dreadlocks. And I told her, listen, I don't want to cause you any sort of embarrassment or whatever. Do you not think it's better if I just don't come? I could just be around in the city and then we'd meet after that. I come to the house and everything. So like, no, it's no one's business. If they have any problem, they have problem and everything. So, but then I should also give in kudos to that particular church also. And at least for those who knew me when I was in church there, who kind of grew up together with, if they had a problem with something you were doing, most of them, not all of them, would all be open with it. They would walk up to you and be like, and some people did. Someone was like, what's this on your head? But then they were not snobbish about it. They were open about it.
Like in a very Nigerian way.
Yeah, in a very Nigerian way.
You mean Nigerians tell you, you're so fast, look at
exactly.
Your cheeks.
Exactly. they see the head, they're like, they don't agree with it. They're like, what is this? There was even one that was like, do you now live in Jamaica? I'm like, no. But I really do appreciate that. Like, there's no point in going back and then whispering in corners when you can just say it in my face.
Can approach it.
Exactly. And I like the fact that they were very open with it in that way. And we could laugh about it and move on with life. So in that sense, that's what I mean by my parents, my mom has been able to accept that this. It doesn't mean it's a lifestyle she would choose for me to have dreadlocks in my hair, but
okay,
she accepts it.
And how has this affected or impacted relationships, intimate relationships, since you chose to...
Do you see? That's a very... I need to do a survey to be sure. That's true. So I have met people who...
Love it?
Who like the idea of being with a man who has dreadlocks. I say I've met, because this is mostly just meeting people generally and not having relationships.
Okay.
I've also met someone who... could only think about what to look like if you cut your hair. And like, the person kept like saying in random conversation, probably just put in, you would look better if you cut this hair. Or what would you look like if you suddenly cut this hair? Not this kind of random droplets from time to time. So if I'm being honest, I don't know what this means to a relationship. I personally think it's a selling point. You should let the person know that our children will have good hair on their head. So I don't know why anyone will have a problem with it.
It's a selling point. You're still selling this.
No,
genetics.
I'm just saying. It also lets the person know that hair products will not be a waste. You can always share hair products. But if I'm being honest, I do not have a conscious awareness of the effects of it on relationships in any sense, if I'm being very honest. I don't know.
All right. We've covered a lot.
Yeah.
And we've spoken for over an hour, which is fantastic. But I do have one area that I want us to touch before we round up today's podcast.
Yeah.
And it's regards with the organization of the TEDx thing. Well, for people out there, if you don't know, now you know, I also have a TED Talk.
Yep.
Out there. Did I say podcast?
No, TED Talk. Yeah.
I do have a TED Talk out there. If you Google TEDx Yaba Adebalogun, you should find my 2017 talk about the hair revolution is what we called it. And it was a good talk. I think that was a very good podcast. So what was it like organizing those talks, coming out with the themes, getting the speakers? Do you think the TED stage is still one that is important? Or is it just now... you know, some people make jokes about TED Talks. I make jokes about TED Talks.
Yeah,
all the
I
time.
Make jokes about TED Talks.
Yeah, you know, so is it one of those things where everybody just comes and like, you know, tries to be smart for 10 minutes and then, you know,
yeah,
the useless space?
So it's a very interesting question because I think it will always be a very useful space. But just like every other tool, also, it has its huge shortcomings. And then, so for me, I think, so my background with TEDx organizing goes way back to 2012 in Ife, right? And over the years till TEDx Yaba and everything, my approach, opinion, and view on TEDx organizing shifted a lot, but also kind of had the same base because I think I've worked with some of the best minds and interesting critical thinkers in across my TEDx organizing. The point is, TEDx platform could be a very, very useful platform depending on who is organizing.
Depending on who's organizing.
Exactly. So you have cases where people organize TED Talks, TEDx events, just because they want to also be in that circle, they want to organize, they want to bring people they know together to speak. But you also have cases where people
want to get some change.
Exactly.
Push the conversation.
Exactly. They see it as a valuable tool towards addressing peculiar concerns they have in their society, in their community. And this is also one of the reasons why TEDx's are localized. Like, you have specific locales, like TEDx Yaba, you have TEDx Bagada. Even when there was TEDx Yaba, there was then TEDx Lagos. And there was TEDx Yaba existing in Lagos, right?
Yeah.
The whole point is that there could be localized situations and solutions that affect those particular people in that space. That might not be general in that sense. So you have people who organize for that reason. But you also have people who organize because, well, it's a cool thing to have on your CV, it's a cool thing to do and all of that. So
yeah,
depending on what it is, it could be a very useful tool. I still think it's a useful tool.
Yeah, I think it is as well. I think, you know, I've watched a few TED Talks that have been very inspiring,
mm-hmm.
and some of them on topics that you get an opinion that is from somebody who's living that experience,
yeah,
more like. And then sometimes you have the fix because
mm-hmm.
the year after I did my own TED Talk,
mm-hmm.
you know where I'm going to with this conversation.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I can see you smiling.
Yeah.
You had Invicticos OB.
Invicticos OB, yeah.
Is it yeah, I could call
yeah.
him Invicticos.
You know the funny thing? So that talk you most likely won't be able to find it online, but it wasn't because of his fraud issue that happened. It was more like when the fraud issue happened, we're like, you know what? He was showing signs. Some of these are supposed to be under locks and keys, but I don't care. I remember looking at Emmanuel Adeboye's face on that day of his talk. The creation, because TEDx talk, as you know, would like there's a whole process of talk, speaker
yeah.
creation, everything that happens. We had gone through like what the idea of what his talk was going to be about, all of that stuff for him. And then he gets on stage, and then he says, I'm going to throw that out. And I'm just going to talk from the well. And what did I say? Like,
what
is this guy doing?
No.
So,
but he came to the rehearsal because
no,
I know there's usually a
rehearsal. He did all of that, and then suddenly, when he's time to speak, he just said to throw all the script out of the window. And that's the actual reason, right? Right? Like, because this wasn't a created talk, we can't put it up. We can't
it's not
vouch
according
for it.
To the theme that
exactly.
we even said.
We can't vouch
which
for
is
it.
Interesting. So, you know, I came for, because that talk happened in 2018, I
mm-hmm.
believe. I had spoken the previous year,
mm-hmm.
and I think I was like an honorary invitee
mm-hmm.
to the next TED Talk. And I listened to that talk, and I wondered to myself, I'm about maybe 2-3 years older than this guy. What have I done with my life? How is this young guy in multi-billionaire, in different industries, in real estate? I'm like, how? I'm like, Ade, you are a disappointment to the entire generation. Only for what? How many what,
yeah,
months
like
or years later?
Yeah, like less than a year later.
We saw the
out.
Real news and I was like, oh, not everything that glitters is really gold.
And that's an important point of the speaker curation, right? The speaker curation is not a censorship, rather a understanding of what the speaker brings and how it particularly affects the audience and how best to pass that message across. So if we've gone through a creation process of your speech, of your talk, and then you suddenly throw it out just to do Pepe Dem Gang or whatever, then it becomes like, yeah, no, that is not what this platform is for, right? Because it's about the idea and the light to particularly shine on that idea and how that particularly goes into the community and what it yields in the community.
In the context of what has been created
exactly.
As well.
So just coming out to then go like, oh, this, that, and that. I don't care how awesome it sounds on stage. It is not going to be. We're not going to put it up online because that isn't the conversation we had.
But let me tell you, I took some notes from that. I took some notes from that consistency.
The devil gives great notes also.
Consistent.
I mean.
He had some really good bullet points.
Yeah, but that was so. The other thing that people didn't know is, maybe we probably don't know unless they probably listen to this, is there were some other speakers we considered for that same year who right now I would not want to have my name written next to theirs, like on the same paper. Not even next, like I wouldn't have my name and theirs on the same paper. I don't care what the context is. And that's an interesting thing because humans evolve. Right. It doesn't mean that
positively and negatively.
Exactly. It doesn't mean that their ideas at that time wasn't valid and wasn't really worth listening. It's just over time there are evolutions that have happened to myself and to themselves that lead to different outcomes. So creating a TEDx session, it's much trickier than people think.
I can imagine. After that real life experience in front of all of us, I can imagine. Well, I'm proud that it did not happen in the same year that I spoke. And I did enjoy that talk.
I should say, when the news came out, there was talk within our organizing team, like, do we need to put out a statement? I don't know if then we didn't, because we're like,
yeah.
We actually don't owe anybody any apology.
You didn't, because it wasn't just TEDx. Like,
it was
the BBC, Forbes, everything. How do you not bring him to speak on TEDx?
Ours was, we found someone in our community who was doing something. Like, there's even a running gag about how if someone is on 30 other 30 on Forbes, there's a high likelihood of the person being a fraud. Like, look, all of them, Theranos, have been there. All of them have been there. And they all turn out to be frauds. But yeah, it's just, it's a whole learning experience. And
unfortunately, this podcast has to come to an end. I know we can speak forever. Your hair looks amazing. I know I did it myself. Locks by Locketing, but his hair is really looking fly. Right, he never lets me post pictures of his face online. Yeah. So, you know. But since we're now in this genetic selling business, maybe we should just post the hair. Like, you know, if you want this hair in your blood,
let's just sell the genetics. I'm also AA, by the way. You can add that to it.
Thank you so much. This has been the Talking Locks with Lockitude podcast. You can find us wherever you listen to your podcast. Till next episode, keep it locked with an attitude. Bye.
Bye.